Welcome to Your Move with Andy Stanley, formerly the Best of North Point Ministries podcast. In this weekly 30-minute message from Andy, you'll discover how to make better decisions and live with fewer regrets. So check out our website at www.yourmove.is for additional ways to watch, listen, and connect. Today is the first part in the two-part series entitled God and Country, and we'll be referring to Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, you'll be challenged by Andy's perspective on the relationship between God and our country. In this message, Andy Stanley gives a compelling argument for continuing to involve God in the affairs of our nation.
I'm sure if you're like me, you've had a few conversations with the television screen lately or with your favorite talk show host, or maybe somebody at work watches the network you don't like and it just drives you crazy and it just assures you of how right you are and how wrong they are. And there are people you just turn off immediately, and there are people you just can't get enough of. And even if you are short on information, you are not short on opinion. And even if you don't have all the facts, you do have all the answers. And if the people in Washington would just give you an hour of their undivided attention, you know, boy, would things be different. And it's so frustrating for all of us because the debate, you know, is Republican and, you know, Democrat, and it's progressive and, you know, conservative and, liberal, and it's big business and small business and too much taxes, not enough taxes, and who's rich and who's not rich. And the debate, you know, is multifaceted. But I think there's another debate going on behind the scenes that we need to talk about. And the reason I think we should talk about it is every once in a while in the life of a nation, and certainly the United States, the issue becomes an issue that intersects with the scriptures. And when a political or a public or social issue intersects with the scriptures, then people who do what I do need to say something. Now, at the end of today's message, I'm going to tell you what that debate is. But getting there, I need to set it up, and I want to talk specifically about what's at the heart of that issue, and that is our national conscience. Our national conscience, something you never, ever hear discussed. Now, everybody knows what a conscience is. You have a conscience, I have a conscience. That our conscience is that thing inside of us that informs our oughts and our ought-nots, right? There are some things you just know you ought not do. How do you know? You're not sure. Maybe your mama told you, but she didn't tell you everything you ought not do. You just know you ought not do some things. There's some things you ought to do, and you're not sure where you learned to ought to do them, but you just know you ought to do them, and you think other people ought to do them, and you can't understand why everybody doesn't ought not the way you do, and that's your conscience, and we all have a conscience. One thing about a conscience is it's like a still small voice. In fact, as Christians, we believe that God speaks through our conscience, that God, you know, kind of elbows us in the ribs and goes, and there's a sense of foreboding, and there's a sense of warning, and there's a sense of, oh, you're getting too close to that. And that's our conscience. It's a little voice, and you can ignore it. In fact, I won't ask you to raise your hands. We've all ignored our conscience at some point. And when you ignore your conscience long enough, it gets quieter and quieter, and you can actually do to a conscience what a guitar player does to the ends of their fingers. You can wear calluses on your conscience to where after a while, you just don't feel things anymore. In fact, some of you, your story about coming back to faith was you became so calloused that you didn't even feel the pain and the consequence of sin anymore until God did something in your heart and you realized, boy, my conscience was so callous because I ignored it and ignored it and ignored it to where after a while, I didn't even feel the pain anymore. Well, that's the nature of a conscience. Now, what we don't think about is this. Every individual has a conscience, but there is such thing as a collective conscience. You have a collective conscience in your family. In your business or your organization, there's a collective conscience. You call it a corporate culture. In your corporate culture, there are just things you do and things you don't do. And people come into your culture and they develop that sense of conscience where, you know, this company, here's what we do, here's what we don't do. You don't think of it as conscience, but it's sort of the culture. It's the group expectation. You have that in your family as well. In fact, the best way to know about the family conscience is if your family goes to visit another family. And you go to visit another family and you listen to how that family operates. And if you've ever had the situation where you went to visit a family where they weren't as polite as possibly your family, and they used words your family didn't use, and they talked about things your family didn't talk about, and your kids, or maybe growing up, you can remember this, everybody in your family's kind of looking at each other like, whoa, I never heard an adult say, you know, whoa. And then you get in the car and there's sort of this silence like, ooh, they do their family different than our family. And you didn't even realize you had like a collective conscience till you got bumped up against, you know, somebody who was different. Families have that, companies have that, friendships, and nations have a collective conscience. Let me give you an example of a conscience issue for the United States. And I'm kind of going out on a limb here, so this may backfire, but I'll try it anyway. How many of you, if you knew you could get by with it, still would hesitate or refuse to take a big bag of fast food garbage that your whole family had collected, and you're driving down the highway? How many of you, if you knew you could get by with it, there's something in you that just won't let you roll down the window and just fling that baby out on the highway? How many of you, you're just not going to do that? No. Now, you know that because you just ought not do that. Now, how did you know you ought not do that? Well, it's against the law, but even if it wasn't against, you break the law all the time. In fact, you were probably breaking the law when you were about to throw it out the window. So what is that? Now, you visit other countries. I mean, I've been in countries, and many of you have as well. I mean, guys are walking down the road, they're taking the paper off the candy bar, and it's just there with all the other trash. They don't eat their countries where they don't even see trash. There's so much trash. It's not even an issue. I want to talk about some other things a little bit heavier than litter that shape our national conscience to basically build a case that there is such a thing. And you never think about your individual conscience or your group conscience until you are exposed to something different, because a conscience is an operating system. It's things we just take for granted. Well, people just oughta, and people just oughta not, and doesn't everybody know, and can't everybody understand? It's such a way of life for us. We're often very unaware of our national or individual or national conscience. Here's some other examples. The anti-slavery movement in England and the United States was fueled by conscience. There were laws that allowed and enforced the way that slavery was handled in England and the United States. And you study the history of the abolition movement, and eventually it was the conscience of England and the conscience of the United States that people finally realized, okay, we have ignored our common sense long enough. This is just wrong to treat another human being. And it was really a war and an issue of conscience that finally turned things over a long time ago. Civil rights movement, the same way. We're going to talk a little bit about that next week. But the civil rights movement was a movement of conscience. The civil rights leaders, you know, black and white, appealed to the American conscience. This just ought not be. This just ought not be. And anyone who, you know, was conscious of their own rationality as it interfaced with the black-white thing, realized, you know what, there's no real way to excuse this. It was a war of conscience, and the civil rights leaders spoke directly to the issue of our national conscience. And consequently, and this is important, laws and regulations were changed because of conscience. Some other examples: our current laws governing abortion are conscience laws. Abortion's legal in every state, but it's handled and managed differently in different states based on the tolerance of the people in that state. That's basically how abortion's handled. In our country, our conscience has gotten sort of okay. Well, if a woman wants to terminate a pregnancy, I guess that's between her and her doctor and her God and however she views the world. And maybe it's not my preference, but I'm okay with that. But our conscience won't allow women to have babies and then decide whether or not they want the baby to live or not. We go, no, that's just wrong. Well, based on what? Well, doesn't have to be based on anything. That's just absolutely wrong. And again, when abortion is allowed is not a scientific issue. It's not a medicine issue. It is a conscience issue, because that line is different in different states, and that line moves as the years go by. It's really a matter of conscience. And as our public conscience shifts and moves back and forth, oftentimes laws and regulations and statutes follow, and sometimes they're overturned. Child pornography laws, that's a conscience issue. We just think it's wrong for there to be such a thing as child pornography. Why do we think it's wrong? I don't know, isn't it just wrong? Don't we all just know it's wrong? And most Americans would go, yeah, that's just wrong. Well, how do you know it's wrong? Well, I don't have to know how I know it's wrong. We just think it's wrong. Well, it's not wrong in every country. Well, they're wrong. Well, how do you know they're wrong? I don't know. Just, you know, they're wrong. Now, there are many, many illustrations of that, but just follow me so far. Now, two other things about conscience, and then we're going to go a little bit further with this. Two insights about conscience. Number one, when there is a strong collective conscience about something, when there's sort of consensus around ought and ought nots, even with flexibility, when there's basically consensus about ought and ought nots, you don't have to have a lot of rules and laws and restrictions. The best example of that is if you've ever been in or are currently in or have ever seen a great marriage, you know that. In a great marriage, there aren't rules. Everybody just kind of knows what you're supposed to do, and you don't have to have enough. Honey, let's review this morning as we get up. Let's review the tens. You don't operate a great marriage. That's how a bad marriage operates. In great families, there aren't a lot of rules. because there's a collective sense of here's what you do and you don't do and you ought not. And we just kind of all buy into that. And it feels so natural and normal. And when there's an aberration, you know, the rest of the family is like, whoa, because that, you know, you've gone outside the lines. In a healthy community, whether it's your company or wherever else, there just don't have, you don't have to have a lot of rules and restrictions and regulations. So in a community, a relationship, or a nation where there's a high degree of consensus around ought and ought not, you need fewer and fewer and fewer laws. Now, the other thing about conscience you need to know is this. A conscience has to be informed. It has to be informed. See, the reason you feel kind of high cringe factor about throwing a bunch of garbage out your window is because someone taught you that. That's not something you're born with. And if you had little children, you know, you have to teach them. You don't throw stuff on the floor, smack, smack. You don't throw stuff on the floor. And then they learn, oh, you don't throw it. They just learn that, okay? But you have to teach that. So even though there is an inherent sense of some things are right, some things are wrong, a conscience has to be informed. Let me show you a quick illustration of that from Scripture. This is from Romans chapter 2. Let me just read you these two verses. Paul is talking about how Gentiles, which are non-Jewish people who didn't have the Ten Commandments growing up, weren't exposed to the Old Testament law, he makes a statement about how what is in their hearts automatically interfaces with God's law. God's law to the Old Testament Jews was a way of informing their conscience. You kind of know basic right or wrong, right and wrong. I want to give you some more information. Here's what he says. He says in verse 14, indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature, that is naturally, things required by the law, they are a law for themselves. He says sometimes Gentiles who don't even have the Ten Commandments, they do the things that are in the Ten Commandments, not because they're in the Ten Commandments, but because they just know in their heart that's the thing to do. You don't steal, you don't sleep with somebody else's wife or husband, they just know these things. Verse 15, they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts. That's the conscience part. Look at the next phrase. Their consciences also, and here's the role of the conscience right here, watch this. Their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts, as the conscience speak, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. Accusing them, defending them. Accusing them, defending them. That's the role of the conscience. The conscience takes whatever information you've put in there, and then it accuses you, I shouldn't do that, or defends you. Oh, that's okay. That's okay. That's all right. Accuses, defends. Based on that sort of general sense of right and wrong that people are born with, along with whatever has informed the conscience. Now, everybody listening to this message, you have an informed conscience. You have been taught beyond the basic right and wrong things that ought and ought not be, and that helps shape your family conscience, your community, your city, and our national culture. Now, all of that to ask this question. So what then has informed, what then has in the past informed our national conscience? We have a national conscience. There are things that just don't feel right to us and don't feel wrong to us as Americans, different than other cultures. It's changed through the years, through the generations. But what informed, what originally informed our national conscience? And the answer to that question is, a sense of personal and corporate accountability to God, Creator. That's what shaped our national conscience. I'll show you this in just a minute. That our national conscience was originally shaped and informed by a general, not everybody on the same page, not everybody seeing God the same way, not everybody a Christian, not everybody taking the Bible seriously, not arguing with that, but a general sense that there is a God who is Creator, and somehow we personally and we nationally are accountable to and should be grateful to this God. That is how our national conscience was originally informed. I want to give you a couple examples. Now, I know this is a bit uncomfortable, and I'm not arguing that the founding fathers were all Christians. I'm not arguing that all the founding fathers saw the world the same way in terms of theology. I'm not arguing that they all took the Bible seriously. I am arguing that there was a sense of personal and national accountability to God that has in a huge way shaped and informed our national understanding of ought and ought not. This is something you memorized in school. Second sentence from the Declaration of Independence. Now listen to this again through the grid of what we've just said. We, that's all those smart guys, hold these truths to be self-evident. That means we can't have a debate because this is just duh. That's what self-evident means. It's like, duh. I mean, we all just see this. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That here's a self-evident truth to them, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these, in other words, here's some of these rights that are, this is important, that are an overflow of the assumption that everyone's created and, you know, has value in God's eyes. Here's three of those rights. Life, you have the right to life. Liberty, you have the right to freedom. And the pursuit of happiness. Now, this is huge. Here's how they view the world. We're going to start, and I get this, we're going to start a nation. In fact, we ought to break off from England. We ought to break off from England. Now, why do you guys think you ought to break off from England? Well, we ought to do so because of the way that God has designed mankind, and we're not able to act in a way that reflects the way God made us, and so therefore, we ought to start a war and start a nation. Now, obviously, that's not the only reason behind the Revolutionary War, but the second sentence of the Declaration of Independence invokes the Creator and invokes the presence of God as a basis for an ought to. This is what we ought to do based on how God made all men. Now, of course, the hypocrisy of the American Revolution was slavery. But very soon after that, and you know this, you learned this in school, very soon after, this terminology was leveraged in the abolition movement to say, wait a minute, wait a minute. If God created everybody equal, he created the black man and the black woman just as equal, and we're not treating them as equal, and we have an issue. There's duplicity in our system. And this was hugely leveraged throughout the Civil War, and eventually, slavery was done away with in England and here and we've moved on from there. But this language was leveraged. No one ever said throughout, the years building up to the Civil War, well, wait a minute, we're not accountable to God. In fact, in the South and the North, preachers just railed and railed and railed, and they all leveraged the existence of God. There was never any question that we were accountable to God. It's just, how does it work its way out? Then, this incredible speech that we've all memorized parts of it in school, the Gettysburg Address. Listen to what Abraham Lincoln says. And he introduces two words, and this is the first high-profile use of this phrase that we've all said 1,000 times. Gettysburg Address, pulling this way out of context, or lifting it from its original context. That, beginning in mid-sentence, that we here highly resolve, some of you can quote the rest of it, that we here highly resolve that these dead, the battlefield dead, shall not have died in vain, that this nation, and here it is, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. Under God. Now, what does he mean? Read the whole thing for yourself. Abraham Lincoln viewed our nation as a nation under the authority and accountable to God. And somehow he's not afraid to leverage that imagery and leverage that paradigm and leverage that, worldview as he talks about political issues, that we are a nation under God. We don't get it right every time. We're having a civil war because we don't get it right. But nobody's arguing that at the end of the day, we are accountable to God for our decisions. And then in the 1950s, that little phrase under God was lifted out and placed in what? The Pledge of Allegiance. Right. Now we're one nation, and it got inserted in the 50s. Under God. So whenever you say the Pledge of Allegiance or your children say the Pledge of Allegiance, you're declaring that we view God as the one who oversees this nation. Now, do we all agree about God? Nope. Do we all agree about everything about God? Nope. Do we all believe the same thing about the Bible? Nope. It's much broader than that. But there's the acknowledgement that there is gratitude to and accountability to God. And then in 1956, something happened that most of you don't know about. And the reason I say most of you is because for 3.5 weeks, I've been asking people if they knew about this, and no one has said yes yet. So if you're the average person, this is new information. In 1956, our country got a brand new motto. In 1956, literally, the 84th Congress, you've heard, well, it'll take an act of Congress to do that. This was literally an act of Congress. The 84th Congress in 1956 declared that we would have a brand new motto, and President Eisenhower signed it into law on July the 30th, 1956. The president made it a law. And our brand new motto is, "In God We Trust." Now, it had been on our coinage since after the Civil War, but as recent as 1956, the Congress, The Congress decided our new motto was going to be, "In God we trust." What were they thinking? They were thinking, "In God we as a nation trust." Now, what's another way of saying "in God we trust"? Starting with the word "we." Not a trick question. We trust in God. What's an even shorter way? We trust God. That is our motto. Now, I've been asking people for almost a month, "Do you know what the national motto is?" And everybody I've asked except for one person says, no one has said, "In God we trust." Only one person said, "In God we trust." Everybody else, it was, it takes one to know one? No. Okay, now, here's... Now, I know this isn't new information. I'm just trying to kind of get us to where we need to be for next week. Now, listen. Tomorrow, if you work for Home Depot, you can walk into the corporate headquarters and you can say, "You can do it." And everybody else will say, "We can help," right? If you work for University of Georgia, you know, you walk into the corporate headquarters in the office at the University of Georgia and you just say, "Go." And everybody's going to say, "Dogs," that's right. If you work for Chick-fil-A, you walk in there and say, "Eat," and they'll say, "More chicken," right? Now, let me ask you this. What if tomorrow morning, every principal of every public school, primary, secondary, middle school, high school, elementary school, what if every principal of every public elementary school, middle school, high school tomorrow morning got on the PA system and said, "Kids, as you start your day, just wanted to remind you, we trust God. Kids, today, don't forget. Trust God." Woo! Oh my goodness, you would have thought, I mean, I'm telling you what. Now, that would be so offensive. There would be lawsuits everywhere. I mean, people would be pulling their kids out of school. We've established a religion. And we say, "Wait a minute, it's the national motto. I don't care if it's a national motto or not. You're trying to impose religion." Hey, whoa, whoa. I'm just quoting the Congress. Look, it's on your coin. But we, come on, this isn't the new part. This isn't new information. Nobody's going to write this down like I hadn't even noticed. We, come on, we have drifted so far away from God talk politically and God talk in our nation that now it's strange. Now it would be odd. Now it would be a lawsuit if a public school teacher or principal insisted that their kids get up. I mean, after we say the Pledge of Allegiance, which there's, you know, that's just the National Pledge of Allegiance. Hey, after the Pledge of Allegiance, now we're going to all say the official motto of the United States of America. You couldn't allow them to do that. Why? Because God, in terms of gratitude to and accountability to, has obviously over time been pushed further and further and further and further over to the side. Now, the reason I bring that up is this. So what? I mean, God's God. Who cares? All right? You know, so my kids don't hear about God in school. They hear about God at home. So my kids, so you can't say this there. We'll say it somewhere else. Big deal, big deal. The reason it's such a big deal is because our national conscience, our national ought to and ought not, our national conscience is tied to the existence and the presence and the centrality of God. It's not that we simply are going to miss God or, you know, "Where's God?" and seen God in a while, and the president hasn't mentioned God. I hope God's okay. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with how we view ought and ought not. And the further we distance ourselves from mention of God publicly, nationally, politically, the further away we get from being able to express gratitude to God. We'll talk about that next week. And the further away we get from our national sense of accountability to God. And the further away we get from those things, and here's the challenge, something else must take God's place. So the debate right now, the behind-the-scenes debate that I wish would bubble to the top, isn't about political, you know, systems. It's not about conservative and not so conservative or rich and not so rich. It's none of them. I mean, all those things are interesting, and we can all shout at the TV together and get mad and lose friendships and split families, and I'll never speak. You know, there's all that. The real debate is this. The two groups that people need to start lining up behind, because they are anyway, is the grateful and the accountable. Versus the ungrateful and the unaccountable. It's the grateful and the accountable that say, you know, I know it's odd and I know it sounds funny, but I still give God credit for all the great things that have happened to me in my life and the great things in this nation. And I still feel like I'm personally, we're nationally accountable to God. And the group that says, no, I'm not grateful to God. I'm not sure who I'm grateful to. I guess I'm grateful to myself. And honestly, as bad as it sounds, I'm not accountable to God. The issue is really, are we going to be a nation of gratitude to God and accountability to God? Or are we going to be a nation where we don't express gratitude because it's not politically correct and we're not accountable to anyone but ourselves? Is it going to be in God we trust, or is it going to be in we trust? That is the more fundamental debate. And once we resolve that, and if we have the courage to bring God back right into the middle of the conversation, then at least we've reestablished a starting point for the conversation of what ought and ought not to be. And the thing is, I understand how sensitive this is, and I understand how offensive it can be, and I understand the whole separation of church and state and the screwy ways that has been applied, which we won't talk about that today either. I understand all that, but here's what I also understand. Now listen, then we're going to wrap it up. Here's the question we've got to answer. If our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, now follow me on this. If our right to the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is tied to there is a God who gave everybody that privilege and that right. That's how this whole thing got started. That because God created you and he created you equal with the person on your left and right, you have a right to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and we need to create a system that allows that to happen. If our right to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is tied to Creator God, and we remove Creator God from the dialogue and the conversation, then what is the basis in the future for your pursuit and your freedom to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? If the basis of that pursuit is removed from the conversation and removed from the political dialogue, what is the new basis? What's the new protection for that? What gives us that right? And I'm telling you, until we come up with a national answer to that question, we have no business moving God out of the conversation because we don't know where that will go. But we have a clue where that goes. Because there are other nations with other histories that never allowed God into the conversation to begin with. And you know what went with God? You know what exited when God exited? The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Because God has informed our conscience as a nation, we have given minorities more freedom and more opportunities, which they should have, and that was a conscience issue. We did the same thing with women. We've done the same thing with children, and we will continue to do the same thing. But what happens if we remove the basis that informed our conscience? What happens if we remove the thing, then the person that we was originally appealed to? What happens to our pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? What do you do with that second sentence? You've got to replace it with something. My question is this. What is that going to be? And until we have a good answer to that, isn't it a bit dangerous to dismiss God and hope that somehow, God will be replaced with something that's equally as compelling, equally as protective of what our nation began to protect?
Thanks so much for listening to Your Move with Andy Stanley. We hope today's podcast will help you make better decisions and live with fewer regrets. So check out our website at www.yourmove.is for additional ways to watch, listen, and connect.